for joining us. I'm Diane Rehm. Deborah Hicks has been a teacher and writer for more than two decades. After earning a doctorate in education from Harvard, she found herself in a Cincinnati neighborhood that felt like her childhood home in the Appalachian Mountains. In a new memoir titled The Road Out, A Teacher's Odyssey in Poor America, she describes the lives of seven girls in Lower Price Hill. Deborah Hicks is here to tell us about the special class she created for them. I invite you to join us. Call us on 800-433-8850. Send us your email to drshow@wamu.org. Follow us on Facebook or send us a tweet. Good morning to you.
Good morning.
So glad to have you here, Deborah. I mentioned Lower Price Hill.
Yes.
Talk about Price Hill.
Well, Price Hill, Cincinnati has, Cincinnati is famous for its hills, and Lower Price Hill sits at the bottom of one of Cincinnati's famous hills. So it's kind of almost like you're going into a neighborhood that sits at the foothill of one of Cincinnati's hills.
Was there an upper Price Hill?
There is a Price Hill, and then there is a Lower Price Hill.
Okay.
And interestingly, as you go to Upper Price Hill, the income level rises, and in Lower Price Hill, you tend to have more poor and working class people.
And wasn't there at one point a tubercular hospital in that area?
That I'm not sure about. That's a very interesting question.
Yeah.
But there are, at this, even now, there are just treatment centers for sewage treatment. So it's kind of an interesting, it's a bit of a depressing neighborhood.
I see. And what took you there?
Well, I had a teaching job at the University of Cincinnati. I got my doctorate in education after growing up in Appalachia. And I had a teaching job at the University of Cincinnati in the education department. But I always had this dream of going into Appalachia and teaching and being a teacher. That was something that I dreamed about from the time that I was very young. So I got to Cincinnati for this position, this teaching job. And I heard about this Appalachian community called Lower Price Hill. And I went there, and I grew up in Appalachia. And so I felt like I was at home. And I said to myself, this is where I want to teach. This is where I want to be a teacher.
Deborah, tell me about that growing up for you and where that was and what it felt like.
I grew up in a very small mountain town, initially a town called Rosman in North Carolina. And this was, it's in the Blue Ridge Mountains, so it's a very beautiful area, actually. And I was absolutely a small town mountain girl. But I was a girl with a big imagination. Early on in life, and I grew up in a working class family, so we didn't have a lot of books in my home. But early on in life, I attached myself very strongly to books and to reading and had a huge imagination. And I was basically a small town girl with very big dreams.
Your mom had some golden books.
We grew up with some books that my mom ordered from a mail order service, and we had some of the tiny little golden books. And I just basically, I devoured those, went out to, there was a field near my house, and I went out to this field, sat there reading, and became a reader at a very young age.
Did she, your mother, care about books, education, teaching you to read?
My mom is a working class person. So she wasn't a huge reader, but she did read to me when I was growing up, and she valued books and learning. But mostly my mom is a Southerner. And so I grew up surrounded by stories and by my mom telling me stories.
And what did your dad do?
My dad was He kind of worked different jobs. One of his jobs was a television repair person, but my dad, neither of my parents went to college. They did high school only. And my dad got a little bit of training in the Navy, actually, doing some electronics type stuff. And he went on in adulthood to do different kinds of jobs involving electronics.
And then your own elementary and high school education, what were they like?
It was very disappointing. So I went to school at the age of five. I went to first grade at the age of five. Where I grew up, there was not a kindergarten type of thing. And school, for someone like me, school should have been a door that absolutely opened. But it was not, unfortunately, because I went to a school that was designed not for the sons and daughters of professionals or people who were going to go to college, but the sons and daughters of farmers and factory workers.
Who were expected to become
who were expected
farmers
to become
and factory
farmers
workers.
And factory workers. And mm-hmm. so I went to a very a school in a working class area as well, and I experienced 12 years of absolute boredom.
Boredom?
Yeah.
How'd you get out of it?
My own story is really, really interesting. So I didn't have any big plans to go to college around the age of 16 because I was a very young student. I got a letter in the mail saying I had a scholarship to a local Southern, one of the local small Southern colleges.
Had you applied for that scholarship?
I do not remember applying. It just, I got this letter and there it was, an opportunity. Opportunity knocks. So I was the first in my family. I went to college and I did my undergraduate degree that way.
And then?
Then I did so well in school that I decided to go on to grad school. But still all along having this kind of vision or dream of going into Appalachia and teaching a little bit like that young adult novel called Christie, where a young woman goes into the mountains and teaches mountain kids. But I put that on hold because I went into grad school. I went to Georgetown University first, and I was studying and learning to be a teacher who would teach immigrant children, an ESL teacher teaching English as a second language. And then I got another opportunity to go to Harvard University to the Graduate School of Education because I wanted to just fine-tune my understanding of how children learn. I had this big interest in education all along. So I went to Harvard, and that was like walking into the land of Oz.
It must have been.
It was amazing. For a kid like me from a small town, basically an Appalachian paper mill town, it was like walking into the land of Oz.
How did you maneuver personally?
It was very difficult. First of all, I really did not have any money, so it was very tough to be in graduate school. I truly was the starving graduate student. But I fumbled. I stumbled a lot. I fell a lot. I remember at one point taking a class in philosophy at Harvard because I'd missed a whole bunch of, I had real holes in my education, and I was just totally, totally lost. I didn't know what I was doing, but I just thought, I'm going to give this a try, and I did.
And?
I got a doctorate in education, and I totally loved Harvard. It was the biggest and best thing I'd ever done in my life.
So then, ultimately, you get to Price Hill, or Lower Price Hill. Tell me how that education system is set up.
Yeah, so Lower Price Hill had a neighborhood elementary school. It was K-6 at the time that I moved into Cincinnati. And as I mentioned, I had a job at the University of Cincinnati in the education department there. And coming out of Harvard, I was a literacy specialist, sort of studying how kids learn to read. And I went to the local elementary school and I said to the administration there, can I come here and teach? It was my fantasy or my dream to teach in Appalachia. And then here I was in this urban Appalachian community in Cincinnati. Just a little bit of background about the community itself. So people don't often associate the word Appalachia with the city of Cincinnati, but it turns out that Cincinnati is part of a sliver of Appalachia's history. in the post-war decades, in between the years of 1940 and 1970, there was this huge migration from south to north called the Great Migration. It's a very big part of America's history. And a lot of people don't realize that Appalachian people were part of that Great Migration. There were over 3 million Appalachian people who moved from south to north. They moved into cities to find work in old industry cities like Dayton, Akron, Detroit, Chicago were some of the famous destinations, and Cincinnati was one of them. And it turns out that Lower Price Hill, which was very much an urban neighborhood, it was 10 minutes from the downtown affluent banking city with, you know, gleaming banks and Starbucks coffee, the whole nine yards. But about 10 minutes from there was this very poor Appalachian community. And I went into the school, which was the neighborhood school in this community, and said to the administration, can I be a teacher? And they invited me in, which I'm very, very grateful for.
They invited you into a paid teaching position.
Oh, no, I was a volunteer. I was just volunteering my services.
Yeah.
And I volunteered as a reading teacher, and there was a second grade teacher teaching in the school who invited me to join her in summer school, because a lot of the kids who went to this K-6 school had to go back to school in the summer to make up for remedial learning issues and so forth. So I volunteered as a reading teacher in a second grade classroom.
Deborah Hicks, her new book is titled The Road Out, A Teacher's Odyssey in Poor America. We'll take a short break in our conversation. When we come back, we'll talk about some of the young girls who later became young women with whom Deborah worked and helped and lived. Stay with us. Welcome back. If you've just joined us, Deborah Hicks is with me. She talks about her experiences in Cincinnati, in a very special part of Cincinnati, where she volunteered to teach a very poor community, a very poor elementary school. And then she follows in the book some of the young women she really mentored. Her new book is titled The Road Out, A Teacher's Odyssey in Poor America. Just to go back for a moment to the question I asked you about the TBE hospital, here's an email from Kit saying, yes, there was a TBE hospital in Price Hill, Dunham Hospital on Sunset Avenue, not really in Lower Price Hill, which was defined by 8th and State neighborhood, closed many years ago, and then became a recreation center. Now, let's talk about some of the young people that you worked with, that you met, who, like you, perhaps, had their own dreams.
Yes. So when I volunteered as a teacher in the local K-6 school, and I was teaching alongside a second grade teacher. And one of the first students I noticed and met was a very young girl, 8 years old, named Blair.
And you call her Blair in the book, though that is not her real name.
That is not her real name. That's a pseudonym. And when I saw Blair, I saw a couple of things at once. First of all, I saw a little girl who was very tiny. She looked, in some ways, not well. She was too thin. She looked a little bit sickly. But at the same time, she had this kind of, I guess I would say, spirit about her. Her eyes conveyed strength and precociousness and just a little touch of anger.
And you found out that she had been born prematurely.
Yes, so Blair was born too soon. She was born a premature baby, and she was born with drugs in her system. And I think that was part of the reason she was so tiny, but it hadn't stopped her from being an incredibly intelligent and precocious little girl.
And what about her grandmother?
So Blair's mom had 10 children by different men, different partners, and was not able to keep any of them. Blair's mom had an alcohol and drug problem. And so Grandma Lily, again, a pseudonym, was Blair's grandmother, and she was able to keep some of the babies, and one of them she kept was Blair.
Now, tell us about the kinds of reading that you did with someone like Blair.
So when I began working with these students in second grade, and I followed the same students as they moved into third grade. And then about midway through third grade, I turned to a group of girls in the classroom and I said, "Do y'all want to have your own class?" And this would be a class after school. We would meet a little bit outside of the regular classroom and read books and literature and talk about the girls' own stories. And so a group of girls said, "Yeah, we'd love to do this."
Including Blair.
Okay. And it ended up being Blair and six other girls. And we began meeting every week after school and ended up staying together for the next 4 years.
How did the school system feel about this?
The school system was very supportive, and I remain very grateful to them for all their support in allowing me to hold this special class in the school building and just do everything possible to support my work. And initially, I've always been an idealistic teacher, always had a big passion for teaching. And initially, I went out and I searched everywhere, the internet, I searched libraries, I searched bookstores to find the absolute perfect books for a group of 9-year-old girls living in a very poor community, a community with some Appalachian roots still. And I was certain that I'd found the perfect novels and the perfect books, but it turned out they had something else in mind.
Like what?
My students, including Blair, only wanted to read one thing and one thing only, and that was horror fiction.
Now, read for us from your book, if you would.
Sure, I'd love to. So this is a scene from early in my teaching. I mentioned I taught for 4 years. This is probably the beginning of the summer, just prior to the second year of my teaching. And I'm sitting with my students, because one of the things we always did, especially when we met in during the summer, because we met in summer school as well, is we always began our class with breakfast, because my students were total foodies, and it was a way of kind of building community and developing a sense of relationship.
And so, did you bring the food?
I picked out the food, and my students very much enjoyed it. And so we're sitting at summer school. It's the beginning, just before the second year of my class, and we're sitting at the breakfast table in the school in Lower Price Hill. And we've been joined by a woman whom I call in the book Miss Susan, who was a local community woman who was sort of like an instructional assistant at this elementary school. And she always joined us for breakfast. And she was a very tough, kind of in your face, real working class woman. And so we're sitting at the table with Miss Susan and we're having breakfast. And just prior to that, just a little bit of background, there had been released, it turns out my students were total Stephen King fans. Even young Blair at the age of 9 was reading Stephen King, which is remarkable for a 9-year-old, 420-page Stephen King novels. But we're sitting at the breakfast table, and it turns out that just prior to our meeting, Stephen King had produced and released a made-for-television movie called Rose Red. And this movie was about a haunted house set in, I think, Washington State. And the house was like a character, and it sucked people up and kind of ate them and absorbed people into the walls. So we're having breakfast, and we're discussing Rose Red. So Miss Susan plopped a banana down on the table in front of me. She looked older than a woman in her late 40s. Money was short, and Miss Susan had to work 2 jobs to make ends meet. Her black hair was pinned back, revealing the tired lines on her face. There were shadows under her steel-gray eyes, though these same eyes betrayed a youthful, sassy feeling. She was a proud woman who could beat the crap out of anyone who messed with her. "Eat this. It's good for you," she said in a voice made husky from smoking her Newport Lights. "Did you work late last night?" I asked. Miss Susan worked her night job at UDF, United Dairy Farmers, serving up ice cream cones and floats. Some nights she didn't finish cleaning up until after 1 in the morning. She nodded and muttered soberly, "Miss Deborah, you know where I worked for 10 years?" said Blair. "In hell." "She's a little demon with 2 horns coming out of her head," said Elizabeth. "She's going down. God, I hate to see her go that way," said baby-faced Alicia, who sat next to Elizabeth. "I'm a smart mouth and evil bitch," said Blair. She picked up the corner of her blueberry muffin carelessly, as though eating it were the last thing on her mind. "And my attic is like rose red," she said, thinking once again of the house that she was... that she'd been watching on television. Blair let the fingers of her right hand rest for a moment on the book she had brought from home. On its cover was an image of a bull and the title, Rose Matter. On the inside were accolades from reviews. "A work filled with terror from the very first page," read one. "Disturbing, haunting, King paints a vivid nightmare," read another. "Rose Red," said Adriana, her half-closed eyes coming alive with the thought, "I want to read Rose Red. Actually, I want to see the movie again, because I like it when that ghost lady, she pulls that dude's mom into the closet."
Well, there we are. Deborah Hicks reading from her book, The Road Out, A Teacher's Odyssey in Poor America. Why do you suppose those young women were so attracted to horror stories?
It's an interesting question, and it's a very important question, because that was the question I asked for over a year when I was teaching. And as a teacher, I spent a great deal of time just trying to understand my students and go where they were. So I kept resisting them because they wanted to read horror fiction. But I wasn't asking that very question. Why? Why were they wanting to read horror fiction? It turns out that I got a clue one day when I was teaching, and 2 of my students, one of them was Blair, who I mentioned was very tiny and frail looking, and the other was a little girl named Alicia, who was also very, very small, fair blonde hair, blue eyes, very Appalachian looking child, and they could have passed for sisters. And all of a sudden, Blair and Alicia put their arms around one another. We were at the breakfast table again, as we always were before we began teaching, and they began getting into a giggly fit, a little girl giggly fit, and they began almost snorting with laughter and turning red in the face, and they had their arms around one another, and they began chanting, "We're sisters, we're sisters, we're sisters." And I was sitting there, you know, getting ready for my class, and I said, turned to them and said, "What makes you all sisters?" And they said, "Both of our moms are out on the streets." And I realized at that moment that this is part of why horror fiction is so meaningful to my students. They're living in a situation in a very poor community that had essentially it had gone ghetto. It had turned into a modern day ghetto, even though the original Appalachian migrants came in and were they were poor, but they were working and they had sort of a coherent, they had a family structure that prevented things from going over the edge. But things had gone over the edge. And I realized that the actual lives of my students were more like a horror fiction novel than they were like these gentle, character-focused stories that I'd picked out for them.
Such as?
A Blue-Eyed Daisy, which was a lovely, lovely novel for young readers. It's a beautiful novel about a kind of West Virginia girl with a working-class dad and all kinds of connections to the girls' lives, but they were connecting more with horror fiction. It spoke more to their experience.
And you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. And you write about that sense of sisterhood that they did develop. And your role in that was what? To encourage that kind of relational behavior or to simply note it?
Well, mostly, I mean, I was the teacher, so I was not family, but I wanted to create a family-like environment because as I began to work with the girls and they began to open up and share their stories with me, I realized that they needed something that was a little closer to a family-type environment than it was a typical school-like environment. So I tried to create a very trusting, warm, intimate environment for them to open up and share their stories and read literature critically. And so in some ways, I think I was more like an aunt or that kind of person, something in between that and a typical classroom teacher.
You said you were with them for 4 years.
Yes, that's correct.
Some did not make it all the way through. Talk about what happened.
So all the girls made it through to the end of the four-year class. And we began in third grade and met until the end of sixth grade. And then something happened to me. I needed to leave Cincinnati. I grew up in North Carolina. And when I began doing this work in Cincinnati, I knew that I'd found my life's work. I didn't have to look any further to realize my dream of what I wanted to do with my own life. But I wanted to take what I learned from this experience in Cincinnati and go back home to North Carolina and do other kinds of similar work there and here and there in North Carolina. So I picked up at the end of sixth grade, which would have been the end of the four-year period for my class, and I left. And at that point, my students were just entering adolescence.
Wow.
And they were entering junior high. And that's a very tough period for
a
young girl.
Tough time.
Yeah.
And what happened to them when you left? And how long were you gone?
I left permanently. I live in North Carolina at this point, and I came back to my native state and founded a program for Appalachian girls in the North Carolina mountains. But my students entered adolescence with a lot on their shoulders. And it's not so much what happened to my students, it's what happened to their families. So two of my students prior to, you know, during the time that I taught the class had already lost their moms. And Blair was one of them. Her mom was never able to raise her. Mariah was another. She'd been taken away from her mom at a very young age. And after I left at the end of the class, two more of my students lost their mothers. And one of the girls' moms ended up dying from a drug overdose and being found in an alley. So that's what my students were dealing with as they were dealing with adolescence.
Did one of them get pregnant?
One of my students had a baby in high school, and that's Adriana. She had a little girl, and she was 16 when she had her baby. But in spite of everything, Adriana stuck with high school, and I'm so proud of her. She finished high school, She graduated from high school and she's now studying to become a hairstylist. Hmm. And she has, against all odds, raised her baby, who is now a little girl.
So what did the experience help you to understand more clearly afterwards?
Afterwards, I realized that, and you mentioned this word sisterhood, I realized that what we had in this class was a sisterhood, and that that was giving these girls something to attach to and a reason to attach themselves to school, because all of my students had difficulty attaching to school. Only three of them, after I left, ended up finishing high school.
Deborah Hicks, her new book is titled The Road Out. We'll talk more and take your calls after a short break. Stay with us.
National broadcast of The Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live healthy, productive lives at gatesfoundation.org. By the Joyce Foundation, working to improve the quality of life in the Great Lakes region. Learn more at joycefdn.org. And by the Grantham Foundation for the Protection of the Environment, supporting strategic communications and collaboration to address the world's pressing environmental problems. This is NPR.
On the next Fresh Air, Adrian Young, a former hip-hop DJ who's now a composer and producer and takes his inspiration from the soul music of the 60s and European film composers like Ennio Morricone. Young produced the new Ghostface Killah album and produced and co-wrote a new album with William Hart, who was the lead singer of the Delphonics. Join us.
Welcome back. Here's our first message on Twitter, which says, I can relate to these girls in Deborah Hicks' book because I, too, was a huge fan of horror fiction. It was a good outlet for my anger. Did you see it that way as well?
I totally resonate with that. That's a great question. Yes, absolutely. That's a wonderful question. And
did the girls express their anger about their situations to you?
Yes, and a couple of the girls were very angry. One of them was Mariah, and Blair was angry as well.
Angry at what?
They were angry about their life circumstances and angry about their mothers having difficulties and having drug problems. And in some cases, they were angry at me, the teacher, because I was trying to push education and push certain things that I felt would help them attach to education. And they turned their anger towards me as well.
How?
They resisted what I offered to them. They resisted reading. I remember at one point Mariah said to me, I ain't never going to enjoy reading. And it was like this wall of resistance to me as a teacher. And I realized at one point, they're not resisting so much me as a person, me as Deborah. They're resisting the teacher because I'm in that position of pushing something that felt initially to them felt uncomfortable or different or new. And so they were just kind of, and I think also, another piece of that is that a number of these girls had had just huge losses in childhood. They lost their moms, to many of them, to a drug problem connected with a prescription painkiller called OxyContin. And they had lost, in some ways, their childhoods.
How did OxyContin become such a major factor in your book?
I did not go into the situation expecting to learn or know anything about OxyContin. I knew nothing about that going in, but OxyContin turned out to be one of the biggest issues that the girls were facing in their young lives.
How?
Unfortunately, Appalachian communities across America have been tainted by a problem with prescription painkiller abuse. And centered around initially around painkillers like Vicodin and Percocet, just painkillers, which people would get for things like back problems or whatever. Enter in the mid-90s a painkiller called OxyContin, which ended up being very pernicious, very destructive. When crushed and either snorted or injected, OxyContin yields a kind of opiate high. OxyContin is a synthetic opiate. And what happened to a number of my students is their moms began experimenting with OxyContin first as a kind of, if you will, a kind of weekend thrill or weekend high, and became addicts. And from OxyContin addiction, next came heroin, because heroin is also an opiate. And to support that habit came prostitution.
And what about the girls themselves?
The girls themselves want nothing of this, and that's something that I think they learned from my class, was to seek something different and better for themselves, and they have totally stayed away from drugs, and I'm very happy about
that. All right, let's open the phones. We'll go first to Jacksonville, Florida. Good morning, Therese. You're on the air. Therese, are you there? All right, let's go to Cincinnati, Ohio. Hi there, Dale.
Oh, hello, Diane. It's a pleasure to be on your show.
Thank you.
I would like to ask Ms. Hicks if she's familiar with Jonathan Kozol's 1991 book, Savage Inequalities, which ends in a metaphor of hope in Price Hill. He's above the city, eating in the Sovereign restaurant, viewing the Ohio River in the beautiful downtown Cincinnati. Above Euler School, which I'm sure is the school she's referring to, in which he worked. And if I may take just 1 second to read this quote from the final chapter of his book. From the top of the hill, you can see across the city, which looks beautiful from here. You also have a good view of the river. The horizon is so wide and open and so different from the narrow view of life to be surmised from the mean streets around the school. One wonders what might have happened to the spirits of these children if they had the chance to breathe this air and stretch their arms to see. And I think Ms. Hicks is answering that question.
Thanks for calling, Dale.
Thanks, Dale. That's a beautiful passage, and I'm very happy to hear you make that connection with my class. I am totally aware of Kozol's book, and I read the book as I was beginning to work in Lower Price Hill and was totally aware that he had spent time at in the neighborhood. I do take issue with one thing that Mr. Kozol wrote in the book, and that is that he never saw the students in the school where he spent time smile, and we had a lot of smiles and laughs in my class.
And you're very proud of that.
Yeah, it was a happy place. It was a safe and happy and warm environment.
Here is a tweet. What are your thoughts on how poverty is racialized, how focus on poor Black Latina women makes Appalachians invisible.
Well, I would just say in response to that, that poverty does not understand color or race. Poverty can affect any of us. And certainly, if you're poor and white in America, you do not have opportunity or access. And I do strongly believe that poverty in America is invisible in general, but white poverty in America is even more invisible because people think that if you're white, you're fine. But not necessarily so.
You know, clearly, Deborah, you went to extraordinary lengths to help these children. How realistic can it possibly be for teachers who have classes of 30, 35, 40 students to go to the lengths you did?
Well, I do believe that teachers all across the country are going to the lengths that I did. I think there are many of us out there who are totally dedicated, idealistic professionals. It's obviously different, but I think we can take what I did in my very small, intimate class and learn from that and apply the lessons to that to a larger setting.
And what are those lessons?
One of the lessons is you have to develop a relationship with your students. And that's something that's a little bit tougher in an era in which there's so much pressure to achieve a certain result, let's say a performance on a single-shot test at the end of the year at a certain time point, instead of stepping back, looking at your students, asking where they are, and then developing a relationship with them around that. That is something that can be applied to any classroom teacher's work.
And what about today's budget-cutting program? I mean, how is that going to affect the work of teachers like yourself or others?
It's very destructive. I, as a person who's committed her life to education for the poor and working classes, I just do not understand the budget cuts for public school. It just seems like the absolute opposite track we should be taking. And it has a huge impact. You cannot do the kinds of things that I was doing, which was very focused, very specific, using a lot of literature that I went out and found, and especially having small class sizes where the teacher
indeed
gets to know the students. You
sure
can't do that if you're cutting budgets at the same time.
What about No Child Left Behind? How has what kind of effect has that had on public education?
It's had, there's some, the good, the bad, and the ugly. I guess we would say the old Clint Eastwood movie. So the good is that No Child Left Behind has given us more specific data about about how kids perform in different cohorts and different poor kids versus more affluent kids and kids of different races and ethnicities. But the downside of No Child Left Behind is that it makes it more difficult for teachers like me and other teachers to address the needs of our students and to go where they are. And I'll have to say that for the students whom I taught in Cincinnati, the No Child Left Behind focus and ideology that developed around that made things worse for my students, not better.
All right, to Cincinnati, Ohio. Hi, Michael.
Hello, Diane.
Hi there.
I'm calling because I wanted to report to Dr. Hicks and to your listeners that things have got a lot better in the school because of reform efforts, and new programs have been developed that address a lot of the programs that Dr. Hicks experienced with her students. Conditions in the neighborhood are as bad as ever, probably worse, but the school has become now a national model of a community school. It has, for example, a dental clinic, a preschool, a mental health services, almost every conceivable social service is actually based in the school. So the school has been renovated. It's bright and shiny.
Mm-hmm.
And I think I said it's now becoming probably one of the most successful community schools in the country.
Michael, I'm so glad to hear that. When was the last time you were back there, Deborah?
Thanks so much for the comment, too. That's just wonderful to hear. It really is. I'm very happy to hear about the positive changes and the many wonderful things happening there. And I've been I try to go back about at least once a year to visit with the girls, the Cincinnati girls, and I will be going back soon, but I haven't been back in the past since, I would say, about a year ago.
Do you keep in touch with them?
Oh, yes. We communicate quite frequently, mostly over Facebook, which is now the new way of communicating with young people. We stay in touch, absolutely.
Now, I'd like to hear about the school work you're doing mm-hmm. in North Carolina.
Yeah, so I came back to North Carolina and I founded an initiative. So I'm from the mountains. I grew up a mountain girl in a small town initially called Rosamond, which is in the Blue Ridge Mountains. And I wanted to come back and build on what I'd done in Cincinnati, but establish kind of a similar initiative in the North Carolina mountains. So I founded an organization called PAGE. It stands for Partnership for Appalachian Girls Education. And it's more of an organization than it is a classroom. We're serving up to 45 and 50 middle school girls living in remote rural communities in the mountains of North Carolina in a county called Madison County, which is a really amazingly beautiful place, but also, unfortunately, has high levels of poverty and Appalachian poverty. So I have established an effort to support education for Appalachian girls out there through PAGE. And we offer a little bit similar to Cincinnati, we offer an intensive summer educational program where girls get together, they read books, they create something called digital stories, which are these 21st century way of creating a story on computers. And they get a lot of support from a team of Duke students, because I'm now working at Duke University. We get Duke students to move out with me to the mountains, and they provide mentoring and support for these adolescent Appalachian girls.
And you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. Let's go now to Norman, Oklahoma. Good morning, Andra.
Good morning, Diane. How are you?
Fine, thanks.
I just kind of wanted to kind of go along with what your guest was talking about a few minutes ago. I grew up in foster care. I'm 24 years old now, but I grew up in foster care, and I was very used to moving around every 6 months, every 8 months, being in a completely different location. And because of that, I developed a very close relationship with books. I always had a book in hand. Now, whenever I was in middle school going into high school, I kind of fell into this group of teachers, and they all kind of banded around me and built a relationship with me, kind of like what was your guest was saying. And there came a point in my freshman year, I was suddenly pulled out of my foster home, and my teachers went crazy. My debate coach managed to get a hold of one of her friends who had been a foster mom a couple years back, and they ended up pretty much saving me from, you know, falling off that bandwagon, and they really taught me a lot about strength and pretty much how to pull myself out of that, you know, kind of way I'd box myself in.
I'm glad you called, Andra. It certainly sounds as though teachers were a very important part of your life, and I'm glad to hear that.
Yeah. Absolutely.
Margaret, who is a publisher and a National Book Critics Circle lifetime member, wrote, "I love this book, which is featured in our current issue, and hope that Deborah Hicks will share the story of the girls creating their own magazine." Can you do that very quickly?
I would love to. So about going into the third year of our class, I had this brainstorm, because when I was growing up, I was a very imaginative little girl, and I loved to write stories. And so I had the idea, we're going to create our own magazine, a magazine of our own, a girl's magazine. So I went out, I wrote a couple of grants, and I got some money to create this magazine. and the girls created a magazine called A Girl's Word. They published stories, they published poetry, and it was a truly amazing experience for them to produce something like that.
Are they still writing, do you know?
Well, in fact, they are. Blair herself is a poet. She writes books of poetry, even though she did not, unfortunately, she did not finish high school. She's an active poet, and she wants someday to publish her book of poetry. Adriana writes in her journal, and she's a journaler. And I think even Jessica keeps a journal.
Wonderful. Congratulations.
Thank you.
Deborah Hicks, her new book is titled The Road Out, A Teacher's Odyssey in Poor America. Thanks for listening, all. I'm Diane Ray.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations.